Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Our hearings this morning are via Zoom, and the sessions are being recorded. So at the beginning of each of your arguments, if you would please state your name and the party that you represent. I know that you both are experienced and know that you each have 15 minutes with 5 minutes of rebuttal for appellant if you choose to use that. So our first case this morning is A22-1291, State of Minnesota versus, is it Berg or Barg, Mr. Burkholz?
I call him Bird.
Berg, okay. And if you're ready to begin, you may.
May it please the court, counsel. I represent appellant Keith Berg. My name is Attorney Jacob Burkholz. We are here on the second appeal from a commit to the Commissioner of Corrections based on a sentence provided by Judge Verrazano in Watonwan County. After a reverse and remand was on the third Austin factor, and the court did not address what appeared to be the remaining argument from our first appeal. So I'll focus on the third Austin factor and the court's remand findings and its transcript, and where I point out our position continues to remain that the district court has not made the adequate findings as required by Austin and Modland. And so in reviewing the transcript, which is very short, and my understanding of this, there was never a written order outlining the court's opinions, but rather its statements on the record, which would constitute the necessary findings for this court to review. In the 12-page transcript, I see the primary focus on page 7 and on, and that is that in this case, the co district court continues to believe that confinement is necessary to protect the public. So I believe the first error in the court is that the violation that triggered this is one single violation. Yes, there was a previous violation for alcohol, but it relates to failing to complete treatment. And what happened in the first appeal, or Berg one, is that I actually brought an expert. I was trial counsel as well, and brought Alpha Emergence as a competing expert as a the treatment provider that was available. And Mr. Berg, at the time of the hearing, I think at the time of the hearing, at least as of sentencing, he was accepted and into Alpha Emergence. Judge Verrazano continued to be, I would just describe as upset with Mr. Berg, and I think that's shown in the findings, just in general, that show, I would say, an improper rationale as to why he continues to revoke Mr. Berg.
I want to make sure that I understand the chronology because, as I understand it, your client was discharged from the first sex offender treatment program and it was in the spring. And I think Judge Verrazano found it, he was skeptical because he, as I understand the record, your client waited until right before the hearing to line up Alpha. So that was a period of months that Judge Verrazano mentioned. Is that right?
Yes, actually, that was brought up pretty extensively because I brought that up. I rarely do this, but I actually interrupted Judge Verrazano in the middle of him committing Mr. Berg to the corrections because he brought that up as a basis for the first time that he sentenced Mr. Berg. He, in fact, said, "Well, your client didn't act quickly enough." And so we actually took intervening testimony from Neil Johnson, the probation agent, and he's because there was a discrepancy in the testimony, because that had not come out in the hearing prior to that, which was, why did you not take action? Well, it's important to note that Mr. Berg did not have counsel, of course. He had no idea what he should or shouldn't have been doing. We made that argument. But even after he hired me, I said, well, what's the problem? The problem was that he had been discharged. Now, Mr. Johnson, again, provided additional testimony that he was not upset and did not even recommend prison for Mr. Berg. That's important. Probation agent was not recommending prison, just that a violation occurred. And the violation was, of course, there was an unsuccessful letter. Well, Neil Johnson, the probation agent, testified that he probably would not have let Mr. Berg sign up and didn't discuss it with him. Now, Mr. Berg then actually provided additional intervening testimony that he had no idea he could. So there was definitely some competing testimony, and the court has never made any findings regarding that, or didn't really provide any additional evidence on that. But I think it's very important that the court, again, continues to place what I would view as improper burden on Mr. Berg, that he should have been doing more, even though no one is telling him to do anything. Mr. Johnson, my recollection of that transcript was that he had no intervening communication. And so there's this, why did Mr. Berg not re-enroll in treatment? He didn't think he had the ability, and there he would have already been violated. And so he wasn't had any discussion on that. So hopefully that answers it. It certainly was a factor.
I had a question on page 15 of your brief. You say that Mr. Berg's probation officer did not feel that Mr. Berg needed treatment until 2020, and the trial court at sentencing felt probation was could probably determine that. But so I couldn't find that in the record, that the probation officer didn't think your client needed treatment, sex offender treatment, when that's what he pled to. Or
Your Honor, that was part of the discussion, and maybe that's my interpretation of how he phrased it, that it wasn't, when he said he doesn't need it, I didn't mean to say that he never needed it, because obviously that was a condition of what was required, but that it wasn't there or necessary in the intervening period, because that's the relevant part the judge was focused on between, I think May 6th was a discharge in the period of time for sentencing. It wasn't that he was never unwilling, he just didn't do anything. He wasn't looking, and Mr. Johnson wasn't telling him to look. And so again, it was perhaps a lack of communication rather than what I call the district court's interpretation of some intentionality in the programming. There's some that he wasn't cooperative. And I go through that pretty extensively in my first brief, how important the I would call the very minimal infractions. And what was so important, and I deal with this regularly with sex offender treatment programs, is that CORE is an authoritarian model of programming, and Alpha Emergence is not. And I would note in the Court of Appeals opinion, which I was a bit frustrated with, the court panel in that indicated that it thought, again, in my brief, that the appellant didn't explain why being unsuccessful, you could still complete probation. Well, actually, that's exactly what Alpha Emergence does. So Alpha Emergence says that you are not criminogenically dangerous and has a completely different model. And I believe that's in the record with the expert, in that there isn't this kind of you either pass or fail. And that's what happened in this case, is that it became a pass-fail model simply because the agent, and I shouldn't say agent, the therapist decided he was not making progress, and that it's this adequate progress is a completely amorphous gray area. In fact, I questioned the therapist, and this should be in the record. They had a secret meeting, not involving Mr. Berg, that she and the other therapists, and I think it included, I think it's Frank Wood, the director of CORE. And in this secret meeting, there was no record created, no notes, no letter was generated. But that she didn't know, when I say she, I mean the therapist that testified, she didn't know what to do with Mr. Berg. And when I questioned her on cross, she said, well, I didn't know if he was making adequate treatment, so I met with my supervisors. And then we all, this AKA secret meeting of unidentified individuals within CORE, said that he wasn't making progress. Well, that was not communicated to Mr. Berg whatsoever. And that meeting happened prior to May 6th. I don't know how many days. But then a letter becomes generated, which he gets and is discharged immediately with no discussion. And so Mr. Berg, I would suggest, is blindsided by this allegation that he's failing to make progress. And I continue to cross pretty extensively the therapist in that first transcript. And she said, well, he didn't bring his homework. Well, he was actually on a job site and he had the homework in his truck. But again, the therapist said, well, if you don't have it in front of you, I'm not going to let you do it. It's the same reason they violated him for a $300 bill, meaning a debt he owed CORE. And so this CORE model says, I am going to send you to prison. Those are my words. I'm going to send you to prison, AKA violate you on a stay of execution, if you don't pay your bill. And that happened. And then that's in the record. And then, of course, they reinstated him. Their decision to reinstate is completely arbitrary. And that's exactly what happened in this case. And so why did we use alpha emergence? Because I understand CORE. And when you do an Alford plea, it's very problematic. Now,
I was going to say, I don't think as a district court judge, I ever saw someone who did an Alford or Norgard plea successfully complete sex offender treatment.
Yeah, I've learned that a few times the hard way.
Isn't there a difference between, I mean, it wasn't an Alford plea. This was a Norgard plea where he said, I blacked out. I don't remember. He didn't say I was innocent when he pled guilty. But that's what he told the therapist when he got into therapy. And he signed a form with CORE early on that said, if I deny my offense, I have to submit to a polygraph. And if I fail the polygraph and I continue to deny, I will be terminated. Wasn't that made clear to him right up front?
I would say, well, let's be very specific. Was it made clear? I don't know. Was it in a form that he potentially signed on some page in some small font? Probably. That's not clear in the record. I don't think that document was submitted into evidence. But I don't disagree, Your Honor, that that idea is accurate within the CORE's historical narrative. And that the narrative is, yes, this is what you must do, you must admit. Now, the actual testimony from the hearing was a little bit more nuanced. In fact, she said Mr. Berg waffled. He would admit and then kind of not admit, and then he would minimize. Now, the therapist doesn't get to control the narrative, in my view, is that she gets to come in and testify. He actually wasn't admitting enough. I think I actually got her to admit that on cross, is that this Norgard concept of innocence versus Alford and are you actually admitting your offense is a very nuanced and very problematic in sex offender treatment. And so, yes, I have learned very much not to use CORE if my client is doing an Alford or a Norgard.
And because, to Judge Flory's pointer, following up on that, he, when he did his intake, said that he engaged in consensual sexual intercourse. He stated he remembered everything that happened around the time of the assault and that it was consensual. So he had this ever-changing narrative of what happened.
I don't think the record's very good on that, Your Honor, of what exactly he admitted to, when and where and how, but certainly, I think the therapist's viewpoint of him, and I think there's a difference between admitting the offense and then admitting culpability within a therapeutic sense. I mean, it's like, yeah.
Could you explain that nuance to me, please?
Yeah.
When he didn't do either, I guess, was the, and I know we're getting a field here, but you know, because we're kind of limited in what we're actually looking at, but go ahead.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I don't necessarily disagree, and that continues to be a theme that I was troubled with in this case too. And I tried to pin the therapist down to say, is the lack of adequate progress because of his admissions? I don't think that's quite what she said. I think she backpedaled, but then she kind of mushed it all together. Meaning, when I say mushed it together, I'm focusing on things like lack of homework. Well, or was it his lack of attendance? Because what is the actual prohibition on making progress, right? I mean, if we're in a 27-month scenario and he's 5 months in and you're doing homework on a pace that I would suggest is consistent with most high schoolers, and I would probably submit Mr. Berg could seem to be fairly consistent with that age, demographic, and ability to do his homework, he's doing pretty well. In fact, I would submit very well in the sense he was complying with homework, making meetings, and communicating this with the therapist. But the therapist, again, seemed to have trouble in the nuances. Well, he isn't admitting enough. I think those, and that's my words, I believe, in cross of what are you asking him to do? And so that's why, again, I go back and say, this is the wrong therapeutic environment. Mr. Berg is not dangerous. He is not dangerous to the public. And again, I wanted to finish and go back to Judge Ferrazzano by saying, his words were that, and I think this is where he makes an error in the Austin-Motlin factors. He says it depreciates the seriousness of the offense. Actually, it requires seriousness of the violation. And the violation is a failure to make progress. And so Judge Ferrazzano goes all the way back and says, I don't think a sex offender, someone that commits a sex crime and has a drinking violation, should be in the public. Well, he actually reinstated him on probation. Judge Ferrazzano did, for that very violation. And now, a completely unrelated violation, takes the exact opposite stance without any explanation. Right. I mean, the factors that are required in Austin, the court has to, with specific and detailed findings, explain why alpha emergence is not adequate or not suitable as an alternative to core. That never happened. There isn't any suggestion or finding that Mr. Berg is dangerous to the public, currently dangerous, or committed any offense to make it dangerous. All this does is it says, well, if you are on probation for a felony level commit offense and commit any offense, you automatically go to prison because it would unnecessarily depreciate the seriousness of the offense. That's not the rule. It's the violation. And then you have to go into the detailed findings. I see my time is up.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. I am having a hard time seeing my timer, so I'm going to try to, I don't want to, there we go. Sorry about that. Okay, may it please the court, counsel, my name is William Lundy. I am a Special Assistant Watonwan County Attorney, and I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this appeal from the revocation of appellant's probation. And I'd like to touch on something that I think Judge Siegel touched on. The scope of this appeal is now very narrow. This case was before this court in what I believe appellant called Berg 1, so I will also refer to it as Berg 1. And in appellant's initial appeal, this court found that the trial court adequately designated the specific condition of probation that was violated and found that the violation was intentional or inexcusable, and thus that the court had satisfied the first two of the three Austin factors. And therefore, any argument really to the contrary as to those two factors is now governed by the law of the case and should not be relitigated here. And I would argue that, you know, a lot of what counsel is talking about with regard to alpha emergence and whether or not core versus alpha emergence is the correct, treatment program for appellant, I would argue that that goes to whether or not the violation was intentional or inexcusable. That is, if he was indeed in the wrong program, then perhaps one could see an excuse for, for failing the core program. But because this court affirmed the district court on that point, I would argue that that really isn't before the court at this point. And so really what we're looking at is that last Austin factor, the third Austin factor.
Mr. Lundy, if I could ask you, but in connection with assessing the adequacy of the court's findings on remand, he does go into the seriousness of the violation. And so that does kind of get us into that territory, doesn't it? Or not? I mean, what's your response to that?
I do think it goes more to the excusability of the violation rather than, when we're talking about, whether, another stay would unduly depreciate the seriousness of the violation. That being said, I mean, I can see where the two kind of tie in, but I guess at that point, the question is whether or not the district court's findings on, whether a further stay would in fact depreciate the seriousness of the violation, whether those findings that he did make were enough in and of themselves to support the district court's conclusion that yes, a further stay would in fact depreciate the seriousness of the violation. And what the court relied on was the fact that appellant had been given two opportunities to avoid prison and he failed to take advantage of either. And as counsel for appellant pointed out, he was, that he had an initial probation violation. First of all, as the court pointed out, appellant was given a dispositional departure from the sentencing guidelines to begin with. So his presumptive sentence was to go to prison, not to be able to, have a chance on probation and complete treatment. So he was given that chance. And then what happened was he was drinking alcohol, which alcohol was one of the contributors
Are the rest of you having antifreeze in your...
Did prohibition drinking not the point?
Why don't we try it with it on? We've stopped the clocks, and if we get those glitches again, then I'll have you turn your video off.
Okay, I apologize, Your Honor. Let me see if I can. Well, okay. All right. I guess I've lost track of where I was. Does anyone have a question that I can answer?
And Marshall, could you start the clock again, please? Thank you.
I guess
I have a question, Mr. Lundy. It seemed to me in reading the transcript and reviewing the matter that, you know, we've been spending a lot of time on whether the violation unduly depreciated the seriousness, but it seemed like the trial court paid more attention to the first Motlin subfactor, that being public safety. And that seemed to me, when in reviewing it, more where the court made its decision on that subfactor. And of course, only one subfactor needs to be met. So maybe you could address that issue at an appropriate point in your argument.
Sure, I would be happy to address that now, Your Honor. I think now's a perfectly good time. The way the court analyzed it was this. The court said that yes, confinement was needed to protect the public from further criminal activity, and the court said that there were two factors that it was considering with that, and it said that there were these two factors that ultimately contributed to the underlying offense. The first was drinking alcohol, and the second was, of course, criminal sexual behavior. And the court found that appellant had a previous violation of probation for drinking. And then he found with regard to criminal sexual behavior that appellant just had not completed sex offender treatment. So the court said, and I'll just quote what he said. He said he had a convicted sex offender who drank while he was on probation when drinking was one of the contributing factors to the underlying offense. And he hasn't addressed the underlying criminal sexual behavior. And so when the court combined those two issues together, he said he sees these things as creating a risk to public safety. And so, these are fact specific and substantive reasons that support the district court's conclusion that confinement was necessary to protect the public from criminal activity. And I want to remind the court as well, although I know you already know this, this is an abuse of discretion standard. So even if someone was to disagree and say, you know, I don't think that those two things taken together really create a public safety risk, that's not for this court to decide. That was for the district court to decide. What this court has to decide is, did the district court apply the correct law? And of course, the court applied Austin and it applied Motland. And then, you know, did it, were its findings clearly erroneous? And of course, you know, again, the facts, I mean, the fact that he was using alcohol as part of the underlying offense, that's clearly supported in the record. The fact that he failed sex offender treatment has already been adjudicated by this court. So there really are no facts in the record that are clearly erroneous that the court relied upon. And so then really the question is just, did the court articulate that on the record? And it did. And therefore, I would argue that the court's, you know, findings are adequate under Austin and Motland, and that this court should affirm. One other thing I would like to bring up is State versus Moot, at which I made this argument in my brief, both, you know, in Berg 1 and in Berg 2. And just to say that this court should affirm the district court, because to do otherwise would be inconsistent with Moot. The situation in Moot was very similar to the situation here. In Moot, we had a presumptive sentence that was an executed prison sentence, and the defendant was given a downward dispositional departure in order to complete treatment. He failed to complete treatment, and the district court revoked his probation. In Moot, the district court didn't even explicitly find that the need for confinement outweighed the policies in favor of probation. But of course, Moot came before Motland, and Motland says you have to actually make that finding, which the district court, I would argue, did here. And you know, because the facts are so similar, I would argue that moot controls and this court should affirm. And also, again, with a person who has a presumptive commitment to prison, the sentencing guidelines expressly say that less judicial tolerance is urged for offenders who were convicted of a more serious offense or who had a longer criminal history. And what's happened is that the legislature and the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, when you have someone who has a presumptive commitment to prison, they've already weighed the need for confining that person against the policies in favor of probation. And on the front end, they say that the person needs to be confined. And in fact, as the court is well aware, the presumption is that the court can't place a person on probation for, you know, such an offense without making a detailed record explaining its reasons for doing so.
Mr. Lundy, you're freezing up again. I'm going to ask you to turn off your video, please.
So the district court expressly relied on the fact that appellant was given. I can hear you. Yes, Your Honor.
Could you please turn off your video? You're freezing up.
And now I can't.
Turn off your video. Thank you. Let's try it this way. You may proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. I guess if the court doesn't have any further questions for me, I will just ask the court to affirm the district court's order revoking appellant's probation. Thank you.
Judges Siegel or Flory, do either of you have a question for Mr. Lundy? Mr. Burkholz, any rebuttal?
Thank you. I'm going to quote Judge Rodenberg in a different matter, which when I get the argument that somehow deference is the only thing that is necessary to apply here. And I'll quote him, and I believe his decision, my case, I like to quote those, State versus Eric Procknow, although it's not a probation violation case, appellate file number A18-1824. And he says, and actually it was Mr. Lundy's boss, Travis Smith's argument to this court, which said, making an argument that the trooper's reliance on 14 factors to support a stop. And he says, the law, that is not the law. Deference is one thing and abdication is another. And I think Motlin and Austin support, and again, Moot does not overrule Austin and Motlin. The court needs to make detailed findings, and that's been supported ever since both of those cases and every published and unpublished Court of Appeals decision since. But the idea here is, where is the analysis that needs to be made? And it was the analysis made. And I agree with Judge Flory, Your Honor, that there's two independent possible factors. And one is the seriousness of the offense, but that would fail. And it would fail on multiple levels. And here's why. Number one, the state granted a downward and agreed to a downward dispositional departure on the initial presumptive commit. So the state's actions and law enforcement's actions, well, not really law enforcement, but the prosecution division and the judge agreed that this was not a commit offense. Otherwise, they would have committed him and never agreed. Number two, even after an alcohol violation, there's continued to be probation. So now what the judge did, Judge Farizano did now, actually is to what I'll consider unlawfully bootstrap the previous circumstances into this case, which is actually what Mr. Lundy argued, that now we get to use previously determined violations to support now the Motlin factors. I could not find a case. I really wanted to cite you something good, but I couldn't find one that seemed to allow that. There isn't an express case that doesn't, perhaps, which is this. Can you go all the way back? Let's imagine we have multiple violations over a period of time, which is actually moot. And you go back and argue, but Moot doesn't decide on the previous violations, nor do any of these other cases. They seem to say that the current violation, and I argue that under Austin and Motlin, that we must focus on the violation. What is this violation? But if the court and Judge Flory, if you were taking the position and were to argue that look, this is a serious crim sex. The public safety is at risk, and he had been drinking in the past. Therefore, he should go to prison now. I don't think that Motland or Austin would support that. I don't think subsequent case law supports that. And I think this court should expressly deny such a request by the state in this case. It would muddle all future cases so badly that we wouldn't be able to tell what the violation is, nor could this court adequately review any subsequent finding. And that's exactly what Judge Ferrazano did, why this court remanded, and why it can't affirm now. The court goes back and muddles the first offense, meaning the original offense, puts him in prison for that now, years later, on this violation, which is just that he failed to complete treatment. And it was unsuccessful, although that's not what they said. They just
The Supreme Court said in State versus Osborne that the district court can look at public safety issues. The court can look at the seriousness of the offense and the intervening conduct during probation. So it seems as though the Supreme Court has said the court can look at the whole picture, not just the present violation.
I agree and disagree. I agree that that is an adequate statement of what has been interpreted as almost like overwhelming dicta, in the sense that where does it apply? If an offender has had previous violations and is unamenable to probation, then it would apply. So how would it not apply? Well, in this circumstance, this is where it doesn't apply, where the kind of generalized allowance of looking back at the original offense and subsequent conduct falls apart. It falls apart in this circumstance, factually, with Berg, because we're using alcohol, which admittedly he was sober and compliant, as a basis to violate him as a public safety risk when he has not reoffended and has had no violations on probation of being a risk to the public, ever, on probation. And that's really the flaw that we continue to point out. May I make one last comment?
You may.
And that is the other piece here, is that there is no analysis by the court as to the rehabilitation, Mr. Berg and his rehabilitation, and the availability of treatment on probation and the time on probation, which I previously argued, which is still an available issue for this court, which I think the Court of Appeals saw as the outstanding issue that wasn't reviewed. I'd ask the court review that if it declines to reverse on factor three. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case was well briefed and well argued, and we will have our decision out within the 90 days. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.